this hour, the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says any Israeli act of aggression against the resistance front could lead to a major war in the region. Iran stresses the need for the formation of an inclusive government in Afghanistan, saying it does not recognize the Taliban as a legitimate ruler. Russia accuses the US of planning to use illegal armed groups in Afghanistan to destabilize the Central Asian region. Thank you for joining us. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement has warned Israel about any act of aggression against the resistance front. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah says any miscalculation by the regime could lead to a major war in the region.
I repeat what I said on Al-Quds Day. You could miscalculate and make a mistake in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Palestine, in Lebanon, in Syria, or in Iran, which could lead to blowing up the whole region. Your miscalculation could be the reason leading to the big war in the region. And the big war in the region will lead you to the abyss, if not to your demise.
Nasrallah also touched on the threats made by Israeli officials against Lebanon. He said it's the Tel Aviv regime that must fear the big war with the resistance. The Hezbollah leader said the resistance front has hundreds of thousands of fighters ready for such a battle. Nasrallah was speaking in a speech that marked the anniversary of Israel's forced withdrawal from southern Lebanon in the year 2000. The occasion is known as the Resistance and Liberation Day. He said the resistance front's deterrent capabilities have been growing since 2000, while Israel has seen its deterrent power diminish. Nasrallah said the recent Palestinian retaliatory operation in response to Israel's attack on the Gaza Strip proved that the resistance front has significantly enhanced its deterrent power. The Hezbollah leader added that now Israel has to pay a price for every attack against Palestinians. A major European trade union organization has announced its decision to boycott products made in Israeli settlements. According to Palestinian media, the decision came during the European Trade Union Confederation's Congress in the German capital, Berlin. The Confederation called for regulatory measures to prevent the European Union's legal entities from importing or exporting products manufactured in Israeli settlements. The body cited the illegality of Israel's West Bank settlements under international law. It also supported the right of the Palestinian people to have an independent state with the occupied East Al-Quds as its capital. The Confederation represents over 45 million European workers and their trade unions. The UN Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement projects in several resolutions. Israeli troops have rampaged through a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. They raided over 50 homes, firing shots at people and lobbing toxic canisters at residents. Our panel at the News Review program discussed the matter.
On this segment of the program, Israeli forces have carried out a fresh violent raid on the occupied West Bank, targeting a refugee camp in the southern city of Jericho. The regime's forces stormed the Arabat Jaber camp from several directions, firing bullets and toxic gas bombs at Palestinians. They raided more than 50 homes, including those of the governor of Jericho and the Jordan Valley Jihad Abu al-Assal and his sons. Over a dozen Palestinians were wounded in the assault, with at least one is said to be in critical condition. Israeli forces also detained 14 people. They prevented locals from entering or leaving and even denied ambulances from reaching the scene. The Israeli regime has intensified its raids across the occupied territories. In recent months, nearly 150 Palestinians have lost their lives in Israeli attacks in the West Bank alone this year so far. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Sandus Al-Assad, journalist and human rights advocate, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also, we have editor-in-chief of Basira Press, Ali Salam, joining us from Moscow. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's cross over to our guest in Moscow, Ali Salam. There's been an uptick in the Israeli aggression and violence against Palestinians, specifically what we're seeing since the start of this year. Talk to us about the Israeli aggression, and what do you think are the motives behind this increase of violence?
Well, the Israeli aggression has been happening since the inception of the Zionist entity. It's not anything new. It's not something that depends on whether the Palestinians defend themselves via means of armed resistance or they sit back and do nothing. The goal of the Zionist entity has just been genocide of what they deem as inferior peoples in order to take their land and establish an outpost in West Asia in order to further expand and establish a political hegemony in the region. But in particularly, the Palestinian people have taken it upon themselves to exercise their natural and legal right to armed resistance. And so this is something that the Zionist entity fears, and this is something that they've been cracking down upon. And this armed resistance has been existing mostly in Gaza for many years, but it has almost miraculously sprung up in the West Bank, maybe only for a few years. So it's been something that's been very heroic and has caught the Zionist security establishment by surprise. And it is something that has brought the Zionist security establishment practically to its knees. And it is causing many further weaknesses and fractures within the Zionist entity. And they're desperate to try to snuff out this resistance, but the more and more that they try, the more and more that they fail.
All right, let's cross over once again to Sandus Al-Assad, who's joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Ms. Al-Assad, if you're with us, I want to get your thoughts on the increase of Israeli violence and aggression that we're seeing against Palestinians. Our guest in Moscow, Ali Salam, was speaking about the reprisal attacks and the retaliatory operations that we're seeing against Israelis coming from Palestinians. How significant are those?
What's going on Palestine is part of parcel of the Israeli hostility against the Palestinians and against the entire people of our region. The ongoing crimes and atrocities that are being committed by the Zionist occupation gives the Palestinians the legitimate right to resist this temporary occupation and gives the entire resistance in the region this right that this regime is an odd regime in our region, and we have the right to resist it and resist its hostilities. And this regime couldn't have committed these crimes without the green light given by the Western government, especially the American administration. We haven't seen that the UN and the other international bodies taking effective measures to put a stop for these crimes and for these atrocities. And unfortunately, at the same time, we see that that some Persian Gulf monarchs are normalizing ties in order, which is another green light for this occupation, to shed the blood of the innocent Palestinians and to demolish their house and to loot their lands.
Ali Salam, one thing that we're seeing in the face of the Israeli crimes that are continuing against the Palestinians on a day-to-day basis is the silence of the international community. I want you to explain that inaction coming from international bodies, such as the United Nations, such as OIC, such as the Arab League and other Arab governments. And the question is, how can the status quo ever change given the unequivocal support that the Israelis receive from the United States?
Well, the United Nations may as well be called the useless nations, because it's essentially a smiley face cover-up for American imperialism and the Zionist occupation. Whatever toothless letters that they write against some aspects of Israeli crimes is totally and totally insufficient for the gravity of the, let's be honest, genocide that is happening against the Palestinian people. That includes also various NGOs. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz once reported that Amnesty International was an official front of the Israeli foreign ministry in the 1970s. And if we see their record in supporting regime change against the biggest supporters of Palestine, such as Syria and Iran, with many of their fake news and dubious reports about alleged human rights abuses in those countries, we can see that they still serve the Zionist agenda and the American agenda until today.
But allow me to thank my guests, Sandos El-Assad, journalist and human rights advocate, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and thanks to Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press, joining us from the Russian capital, Moscow. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the Newsery.
Iran's foreign minister has underscored the need for the formation of an inclusive government in Afghanistan. Hossein Amir Abdollahian said Tehran does not recognize the Taliban as a, quote, legitimate ruler. The Iranian minister said Iran is dissatisfied that an inclusive government has not been created yet. Tehran has raised the concern with Taliban officials. The minister also touched on Iran's dispute with Afghanistan over shared water resources. He said Tehran has told the Taliban that political statements are not enough to settle differences. The Iranian minister said necessary measures under a 1970s agreement between Iran and Afghanistan need to be taken. The minister said Iran believes diplomatic engagement is the only effective option. He said Tehran seeks to help promote peace in Afghanistan and it expects Afghan officials to reciprocate. Iran has unveiled the fourth generation of its long-range ballistic missiles, marking the anniversary of the liberation of the city of Khorramshahr during the Iran-Iraq War. Gisumish Ahmadi has more.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
A successful first launch operation. Iran has test-fired its most advanced ballistic missile. The fourth-generation Khorramshahr-class long-range ballistic missile dubbed Khaybar is a liquid-fueled precision-guided missile that can carry a 1,500-kilogram warhead and accurately hit targets 2,000 kilometers farther.
Khorramshahr 4 is the developed version of previous models and is a stealth missile. It can easily bypass enemy air defenses due to its low radar cross-section. It is the result of years of hard work of our engineers at the Aerospace Industries Organization. With its impressive tactical capabilities, the Khorramshahr 4 missile shows that we are fully committed to defending our country.
Khorramshahr 4 has a unique guidance and control system which allows it to adjust its trajectory as it travels through outer space. The system is deactivated as it re-enters the atmosphere. This important feature makes Khorramshahr 4 missiles fully immune to any kind of electronic warfare counterattacks. The newly unveiled missile also has an incredibly short preparation and launch time, and thanks to its liquid-fueled engine, the missile can easily reach hypersonic speeds of Mach 16 in outer space and Mach 8 traveling through the Earth's atmosphere. This makes detecting and tracking the missile impossible, which means it is totally invisible to radars.
When we talk about our defense capabilities, the name Khorramshahr stands for self-reliance and sacrifice, the two qualities that lead to the liberation of the city of Khorramshahr back in 1982. So this type of missile is rightfully named Khorramshahr. And the fourth generation that was unveiled today marks a significant advancement in Iran's ballistic missile technology while enhancing its defense capabilities and deterrence. This is good news for our nation.
Hello.
شنوندگان عزیز، توجه فرمایید. شنوندگان عزیز، توجه فرمایید. خونین شهر، شهر خون آزاد شد.
All of this is happening on the 41st anniversary of the liberation of the southwestern city of Khorramshahr during the Iran-Iraq War, a major turning point that tipped the scales in Iran's favor, designating the word Khorramshahr as a code name for victory, perseverance, and self-reliance.
And what better way to celebrate the liberation anniversary of the city of Khorramshahr than by unveiling this ballistic missile? Khorramshahr 4 is a precision-guided missile which is considered a symbol of determination and self-sufficiency. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
The Russian defense minister has accused the U.S. of planning to use illegal armed groups in Afghanistan to destabilize the Central Asian region. Sergei Shoigu was addressing a meeting of the Collective Security Treaty Organization's defense ministers. He said such groups have significantly strengthened their positions in Afghanistan after the Taliban came to power following the shambolic withdrawal of American forces. Shoigu added that these groups could infiltrate into Afghanistan's neighboring countries to commit terrorist acts. He also blasted the U.S.-led NATO alliance for seeking to restore its military presence in Central Asia instead of working for reconstruction of Afghanistan. He said NATO's move poses a direct threat to the stability of that region. The Russian president says despite all odds, Armenia and Azerbaijan are moving towards a settlement to their decades-old dispute over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Vladimir Putin made the remarks in a meeting with the two countries' leaders. He said although there are still unresolved issues between Baku and Yerevan, they are of a purely technical nature. He added that Armenian and Azeri officials would meet next week to settle all the unresolved issues. This after both countries stated that they are progressing towards a settlement based on mutual recognition of each other's territorial integrity. Baku and Yerevan have been at loggerheads for three decades, fighting two wars over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. In recent months, both sides have expressed increasing willingness to sign a permanent peace agreement, even as regular skirmishes have continued. Well, that's it for this hour's bulletin. Take care for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Heading a high-ranking political economic delegation, Iranian President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi has visited Indonesia in response to the invitation of Indonesian President Joko Widodo. In this regard, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has penned an article on the significance of this trip, which was published by Indonesia's English-language newspaper, The Jakarta Post. What you are about to hear is the full text of this piece. Please stay with us. The state visit of the Islamic Republic of Iran President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi to Jakarta in response to the invitation of President Joko Widodo marks not only a turning point in the bilateral relations between the two countries, but also the commencement of a new chapter in the relations between the two great nations. The stance of the two countries in the two regions of the West Asia region and East Asia, cultural and civilizational commonalities and weighty potential for cooperation in various fields, alongside the new requirements of the international order, herald the opening of a new era of relations between the two countries, hinged on respect and mutual understanding. The diplomatic ties between Iran and Indonesia are now entering their eighth decade, while the relations between the two great nations have deep roots in history. The people of the two countries, centuries ago, were able to establish profound bonds with each other through Islam, and Iranian and Indonesian Muslim scholars and intellectuals had beneficial interactions in past centuries. The linguistic ties between the two countries also serve as further evidence of the historical interactions between the people of the two nations throughout Asia. A considerable number of Persian words in the Indonesian language and shared assets such as Imam Muhammad Ghazali testify to the depth of historical connections between them and provide a basis for deepening the relations between the two nations. The Islamic Republic of Iran, within the framework of a balanced, smart, and dynamic foreign policy, attaches a special prominence to the development of relations with Indonesia. Fortunately, this determination exists on both sides, and the authorities of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Republic of Indonesia are resolute to create the required infrastructure and facilities for the development of relations in various fields. The bilateral negotiations between the two countries encompass a wide range of bilateral, regional, and international topics. Iran and Indonesia seek to deepen cooperation in various areas, including political, economic, trade, energy, scientific and technological, cultural, parliamentary, and security fields. Despite the excellent relations, constructive cooperation, and mutual support in international forums, it must be acknowledged the current volume of trade relations between the two countries is below expectations given the available capacities. Therefore, President Raisi and his accompanying delegation in this journey to Jakarta provide a valuable opportunity for the public and private sectors of both countries to become more familiar with each other's economic and commercial capacities and capabilities. The links between Iran and Indonesia within the framework of South-South cooperation have a historical background and demonstrate the common approach of the two countries to create a balanced world. The two countries have common positions on regional, international, and Islamic issues, and continuous negotiations between the two sides on these matters are ongoing. Recognizing the need to strengthen regional relations, we commend the performance of ASEAN and emphasize the Islamic Republic of Iran's willingness to develop relations with other member states of the regional bloc within the framework of the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation signed between the two sides in 2017. We consider Indonesia's chairmanship in ASEAN an optimal opportunity for developing relations with the other member states of this progressive grouping. We also welcome the possibility of regional connections between ASEAN and the Economic Cooperation Organization, ECCO, in West Asia. Issues such as the necessity of unity among Islamic countries, promoting the true image of Islam in the world, combating extremism and Islamophobia, and supporting the interests of Muslims worldwide, including the oppressed Palestinian people, are the points that align the foreign policy of the two countries on a common path. Within this framework, we believe the West Asian countries, as an environment with the highest number of Islamic countries, can overcome existing misunderstandings, and regardless of the intervention of non-regional powers, establish an intra-regional order. Negotiations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia are taking place in this regard. We believe the two countries have embarked on the right path, and this understanding will bring tangible results for the stability and prosperity of the region and the Islamic world. As an influential bloc in global equations, the Islamic world requires greater convergence to create opportunities for consensus, synergy, and the generation of innovative ideas benefiting the great Ummah, worldwide Islamic community. Undoubtedly, countries that have noteworthy weight in the Islamic world can play a leading role in realizing the interests of the Ummah. Based on this, Iran welcomes the strengthening of cooperation with Indonesia as one of the essential and influential predominantly Muslim countries in the world. From the perspective of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the unilateralism prevailing in the world, with the elimination of multilateral mechanisms and its detrimental effects on global peace and security, has now been marginalized. In other words, the security of the international system does not have a prescribed nature and has been transformed into a synergic and participatory matter with the maximum involvement of actors. The founding fathers of the historic Bandung Conference and the proponents of the paradigm of non-alignment decades ago rightly took steps in this direction and expressed their opposition to any polarization that would endanger world peace and stability. In the new international context, developing and emerging countries, through cooperation and shared efforts, can play a constructive role in ensuring global peace and stability, including in the areas of food security and energy. In conclusion, I would like to emphasize the serious commitment of the authorities in my country to the development of relations with the friendly and brotherly country of Indonesia. Indonesians are noble and hospitable, and I am deeply pleased we are in Indonesia accompanying President Raisi. I wish felicity, prosperity, and progress for Indonesia's government and great people.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear ladies, welcome to a new episode of Muslim Lady. Well, this is IRB English Radio. I am Asma, playing your host for today. And Sister Zainab is here with me. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum assalam and assalamu alaikum to you and your listeners.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Well, we are going to talk about the reasons of why a woman would take all that much of risk, all that much of difficulties to get into a job.
We talked about so many things like women being in workplace, the challenges she faces,
Penetrated actually into it because we talked too much about the guilt and the mental breakdown that she's going to face.
Exactly. And I think that was important to go through these things. There's a much to talk about, mm-hmm. but like we just had a gist of all. Why she's putting herself into that much trauma physically, emotionally. There are many reasons for many kind of, there are different kind of women working in a society and every woman has her own reason.
Yeah.
But the main reason, as per the research, as per the statistics that we have available, is that she wants to be a financial help to the family.
Yeah, so the first reason is that life in modern day is very difficult. So one person working outside is not going to be enough for the family to provide them with too much of facilities.
Exactly. And that's why we have, again, so much in Quran, so much in narrations about the charity, about helping each other, about being, shoulder to each other, about being kind and generous. We have so much about generosity, like Imam Hassan alayhi salam would give his entire property to wives and half of his property once, and then, the most generous is called Karimul Ahl al-Bayt, the generous of the Ahl al-Bayt. Imams teach us from their practical way of life they have lived to be generous. When we are generous, maybe someone who is forced to work outside, he does not like or does not wish to or is not able to manage or is not able to face all those challenges that we have been talking about, maybe it would be a help.
Yeah, so again, we come to the very factor that Islam recommends all of us to take care of each other.
Take care of each other,
so
yeah.
So if my sister does not have enough of money and I have it, I can share half of my things with her in a way that we would make up for all the things that she does not have.
It was so beautiful. I heard someone saying that she was a very rich lady. She said that, all my life I had been earning money, and the more amount of money I used to earn, I did not feel very good. But the moment I felt good was
the moment I gave them away.
When I shared it.
Yeah.
When I started taking care. So earning did not make me mentally happy. It was giving away that made
exactly,
me happy.
Exactly, yeah.
So that's what Islam also recommends you. So Islam is actually very much keen about your mental health, which will make you feel good. Which activity of yours will release feel-good hormones in your body. So yeah. I was very keen about it. So our teachings are not baseless. Our narrations are not baseless. They are very perfect at their place. So another reasons why a woman goes out who works. Now, we are not here to degrade all women, like why you're working. You should not be working. You should be staying at
home. No, of course not.
So another reasons are like she wants to explore her skills at a social level. It's very important as per the
That's justifying.
Yeah, a leader, as per the supreme leader of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, he says that it's better for a society if we have women as doctors.
Exactly, yeah.
As in the, daycare institutions, in the childcare institutions, mm-hmm. if we have women, it's far better than we have men over
and
there.
And we as women know how great it is when you go to a doctor, when you go to, a place that the person in front of you is going to be another woman just like you.
Exactly.
You
like I remember I skipped many times checking my blood pressure in my country because the opposite person sitting in front of me as a doctor was not from my gender, was like a male or was not a female. So I had to skip an important checkup. I had to skip, like, I don't know, during my pregnancies, or sometimes it was really important to have that checkup because
You did not feel comfortable with that.
Exactly. As you said, like, you know, how good it feels.
It's a blessing to have women in society who are just helping the other women, you know, in being a doctor, in being a teacher.
For me, it was a very amazing thing to be, you know, coming to this country and seeing women excel, explore, and that too in hijab. That was the most amazing thing for me.
So I guess this second reason that you just mentioned is the most honorable, appreciable, and admirable reason of why a woman goes to hijab.
Exactly, because even if she is now going, because in India, probably you won't accept that, okay, I will go to a higher level job or I will go to a higher level profession maintaining my hijab, or in many other countries like that. But in Iran, I was amazed because in the very first flight that I came, the woman was the pilot.
Yeah.
And had to in hijab. Mm-hmm. So that was again, amazing.
It's a matter of pride for all the women.
Exactly. Then another thing that was amazing for me over here was that seeing all the women running an institution, which is one of the topmost institutions, one of the topmost seminary schools, which accepts students internationally. And I saw from a servant to a head of the institution, all are women, and that too, they are all in hijab, and that too, this kind of climate, because I was not able to tolerate it for some 1 month or so. It was so, so hot, but I was like, they are so comfortable in doing this.
Yeah, and we also have those hospitals that are just instructed by women.
That was another amazing thing I found at the time of my delivery here. That I went to a hospital and from the someone who gives me slippers, makes me prepared for getting getting checked up by a doctor, and to the expertise, all are women.
So according to what we say, I guess it's pretty much clear that we do not say that women working outside the home is not a good thing and they should quit that. Of course not. All we care about is the mental health of a woman who's working outside the home, and this balance that is very difficult for her to create between her family and her work. We are going to go for a break, and then after that, we'll go for the rest of the story.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Yes, Muslim ladies, welcome back. Well, women are great creatures who can do too much of responsibilities at the very same time. And this is very astonishing. As for me, even thinking about it makes me so scared, because doing too many things at the very same time seems to be impossible. But many women are doing that perfectly. I mean, yes, their family are going to tolerate too much. I mean, the kids, they're going to see their mothers less than the other children who've got their mothers at home. And maybe the husband have got a lot of things to say as well. But they're doing an important part in society. They are actually fulfilling the missions that has been put on their shoulders.
So yeah, we were talking about the reasons why actually a woman goes out for work. So. Yeah. Some of the women really don't have, that kind of thinking that I want to be a financial help to the family. But they have this feeling of being independent. They want be independent. And many other are there who don't have all these reasons, but they simply want to escape loneliness.
This is also another reason.
And seriously, there should be some of the health groups in the society who should address to mental health of a woman, which is very, very important. And because of this, you know, just to escape loneliness, women go out to work and then they face all those challenges we talked about, or many more challenges than that.
So you ignore the home, you put it aside just because you want to ignore things.
Exactly.
Also, there's another reason that I would love to add, which is the influence of media. Sometimes many women think, okay, she has got money. I mean, she's living in a perfectly wealthy family. But still, she feels that I have to go for a job.
Which is a policy, you know, with the slogan of freedom of women. They actually want to control the population. They have engaged her so much into the work. They have engaged her so much into the, you know, economic
life. So you mean that she is busy enough that she does not think about creating a family or breeding even.
Exactly.
And then her psychological clock is going to tick at a certain age. And when she's alone...
Again, like as we said, then she has to escape her loneliness. Then she has to escape all those traumas. She again has to work. We have these propagandas today that women should be free. Women should be, you know, there's gender inequality. There's gender injustice.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's
making
so
a family.
Sad. The woman that is working too much, the woman that is giving too much of herself to this work, that to these jobs that she's taking, after a certain time, she's going to get old. She can no longer go for making a family or having children. Then she becomes lonely. And then at that time, all the jobs that she has been through, all the work that she has done, are not going to do her anything. And this is really tragic.
Exactly. It is. And, you know, just thinking about the economic growth of their country, that's another government reason that they want women forced to be in, because half of the population consists of women, obviously. And when half of the population is unworking, that means your economic GDP is not much. You're not, you don't have that gross production development economically. So they drive women into the work, especially they know that women work for less salaries.
Yeah.
So because women really don't have this, I just said there are many reasons that they want to be independent, or they just want to explore, or many want to gain experience. And they don't demand much salaries. But men are not like that. Mm-hmm. When men work, they work for salaries. They work for huge salaries. They demand high. But from women, they're easygoing. And they're like, they say, no, she is cheap. She is, you know, she's affordable. And we can use her beauty, actually, you know, to drive more.
Yes, exactly.
Much of the money.
To attract more of customers.
Exactly.
And, you know, what is even more sad is the fact that when you think about it, when you come to scrutinize into this fact, you come to see the story as this, that too many of us are working as servants, unconsciously actually. We are being the servants of a higher and bigger power.
Exactly.
And this is very sad, really, especially for women.
As the, again, Supreme Leader calls it a Zionist conspiracy, which is plotted, which is actually taken into, which is put into action by the United States and other superpowers like that. And it is definitely a conspiracy.
Yeah.
It is definitely a plot.
So they cover their wild intentions with beautiful slogans, just like equality of genders and women are as the same of men and things like that. But what the truth is, and what we see in reality, is the fact they are using women for their own benefits.
And today, women all around the world have realized this. You can see that the biggest manifestation of that is the protests on the International Women's Day all around the world.
Yeah, that's very true. So I guess as women, whatever we're doing, we said that there are too many jobs that many women are doing, and we are so much respecting them because their presence in society is just like a blessing for every woman, and they're helping. But aside from that, there are too many jobs that if they did not exist, nothing would go wrong in this life. You know what I mean? Many women are actually being a part of a bigger game and they do not know it. So I guess we have to think about these issues more and more. And yeah, take care of yourself. And until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is under pressure over his claims about the state of dentistry, as figures reveal that the number of active NHS dentists in England is at its lowest level in the past decade. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Morning Star has covered this story and tells us more. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak must drop any pretense that the National Health Service dentistry is on the road to recovery and finally deliver a meaningful rescue package, the British Dental Association, the BDA, has warned as the exodus from the service reaches new heights. A Freedom of Information request by the British Dental Association, published on Tuesday, 23rd of May, reveals the lowest number of dentists available in a decade, in what the association called a reality check on months of misleading claims from the Prime Minister. The British Dental Association found that 23,577 dentists performed National Health Service work in the 2022-2023 financial year, down 695 on the previous year, and down over 1,100 on pre-pandemic numbers. It brings the workforce to levels not seen since 2012-2013. The figures are at odds with repeated claims from Rishi Sunak
that recent reforms have boosted dentist numbers and arguments by ministers made to the current official inquiry into the crisis. Practices are struggling to fill vacancies, which means they face fines for not hitting their NHS contractual targets, according to the British Dental Association. It estimates that practices will have to pay back more than £400 million for not hitting their targets this year. The British Dental Association is calling for a new higher minimum unit of dental activity value, which it says could help stop dentists having to treat NHS patients at a loss. A minimum unit of dental activity value level of £23 was rolled out last October, lower than the current patient charge level of £25.80, and below the level required for most practices to cover their costs or attract new dentists into the profession, it said. The British Dental Association General Dentist Practice Committee Chairman Sean Charwood said, "Government needs to drop the spin, accept the facts and provide a rescue package to keep this service afloat. National Health Service dentistry is hemorrhaging talent and further tweaks to a broken system will not stem the flow." The Prime Minister once called for this budget to be ring-fenced. "We face an access crisis, and with hundreds of millions set to be pulled away, funds must be put to work solving these problems." Ministers have a choice. They can help thousands of struggling practices fill their vacancies and see patients, or just pass by on the other side. Toothless in England, the campaign group demanding an NHS dentist for everyone in England said, "Children, adults and the elderly are left hopelessly abandoned and forgotten by the National Health Service and the government. Patients who contact us are often in extreme pain. They're getting increasingly angered by the lack of accessible dental care in England." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is under pressure over his claims about the state of dentistry, as figures reveal that the number of active NHS dentists in England is at its lowest level in the past decade, leaving millions of people struggling to get checkups or have toothaches fixed. The British Dental Association, the BDA, has warned of an exodus of dentists from the National Health Service, as it published figures showing that the workforce has been reduced to a level not seen since 2012-2013. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has repeatedly said that 500 extra dentists had been recorded as providing NHS services in the 2021-2022 financial year. A growing number of dental surgeries do little or no National Health Service-funded work, with the British Dental Association citing a £3 billion dental budget that has failed to keep pace with inflation and population growth over the past decade. A total of 23,577 dentists performed National Health Service work in the 2022-2023 financial year, down 695 on the previous year, and according to a response to a Freedom of Information request from the NHS Business Services Authority. That figure is more than 1,100 down on pre-pandemic numbers. The loss of dentists within the system has led to nearly 6 million adults trying and failing to get a National Health Service dentist appointment in the past 2 years, according to a recent analysis by the British Dental Association. The official figures on the NHS dentistry workforce appear to contradict the Prime Minister's claims that recent reforms have boosted the number of dentists. The British Dental Association said it thought the Prime Minister was relying on a rise in activity from dentists in the National Health Service in the financial year 2021-2022 that had naturally followed the end of the COVID lockdown. Sean Charwood, who chairs the British Dental Association's General Dental Practice Committee, said the government needs to drop the spin to accept the facts and provide a rescue package to keep this service afloat. National Health Service dentistry is hemorrhaging talent, and further tweaks to a broken system will not stem the flow. The Prime Minister once called for this budget to be ring-fenced. We face an access crisis, and with hundreds of millions set to be pulled away, funds must be put to work solving these problems. Ministers have a choice. They can help thousands of struggling practices fill their vacancies and see patients, or just pass by on the other side. The British Dental Association, the BDA, has been asking ministers to recycle money returned to the government by dentistry practices that have been unable to hit their contractual targets. It is estimated this money could exceed £400 million this year. The fall in workforce numbers highlighted in the figures is also said by the British Dental Association to underplay the full scale of lost capacity in National Health Service dentistry. A recent British Dental Association survey of dentists in England revealed that half of dentists, or 50.3%, had reduced the proportion of National Health Service work they did by more than a quarter since the start of the pandemic. And 74% of the dentists indicated they plan to reduce the amount of NHS work that they undertake in the year ahead. The National Health Service Business Services Authority did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The Department of Health and Social Care spokesperson said the latest figures might be lower than the previous year due to not all NHS dentists having submitted their data for the last financial year. The spokesperson said, "We're working to improve access to National Health Service dental care and have already increased the funding that practices receive for high-need patients to encourage dentists to provide more National Health Service treatments." The Department of Health spokesperson added, "We have also amended the guidelines so dental therapists and hygienists can deliver more treatment, as well as making it easier to recruit dentists from overseas. And we will be setting out further measures to improve access shortly."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.